So with this talk, we begin our journey with conditioned arising, dependent arising, a journey through the things that have to do with conditionings and how one thing conditions another. One thing arises in dependence on other things. It's considered to be one of the profound teachings of Buddhism. And to make it very simple with a kind of example, if you go through life, your whole life, with your hands fisted up, in a fist, that would create very different conditions than if you went through your life with your hands open, palms open. If the soft, tender part of your palm was always closed off from the world, create a very different experience than if the soft palm of the hand was available. It would be very different to go through the world, the whole life, with the heart closed, and go through life with the heart open. It'd be very different conditions, and it would condition our experience at the influence, the kind of life we have, if we spent our whole life with the mind closed, or if we spent our life with our mind open. If we spend our life being stingy, that lends itself to being influenced in a certain way. The world responds a certain way to that. The heart responds in a certain way to that. We get our disposition, our psychology is influenced by that. And if we go through our life being generous, that sets in motion very different conditions. The world responds differently. Our heart responds differently. Different disposition is created. Different psychology is almost created if we do it that way. If we go through the world, through our life selfishly, that puts in place very different conditions that influences the outcome and consequences very differently than if we do not go through life selfishly, if we are unselfish. And so to appreciate how these different ways of being are not absent of conditioning. We don't do them freely. It has no consequence that we do them. That all these different choices or always different ways of being have consequences. It's not actually, we can't be sure exactly what those consequences will be or predict what they're going to be. They may be in different circumstances, they have different consequences, but the conditioning, the influence they have on our experience of life and how life responds to us and how we respond to ourselves and how we move through onwards is very different. And so the Buddhist teachings on conditionality is exactly this. That certain, and mostly what they're focusing on here in the teachings of the Buddha, are the conditions of our own inner life, the conditions of our mind, the conditions of our hearts, that if there are certain inner mental conditions in place, that affects just how things unfold from there. And so it's possible to care for those conditions. It's possible to change them. Maybe not everything, but there's plenty of things we can do. And the focus on the Buddha is not on whatever you might think might be unchangeable about you. This is how you are. Boom. You'll always be this way. What the Buddha's focus is on is what you can do, the actions you can do, the mental actions, the verbal actions, the physical actions you can do that influence the conditions of your life, influence the flow, the direction these conditions go. And there are generally three different kind of ways that this can go. One is that it can go towards something which it can go towards suffering. It can go to have consequences. Conditions can be in place that tend to lead to more suffering, more distress. And the conditions that lead to suffering are also the conditions that influence our own inner life and tends to perpetuate that which is unwholesome within us, non-nourishing, that which is somehow deflating or drains us, the vitality of life from us. And so a classic description of this would be the five precepts. If you do the opposite of the precepts, this has a very different effect on a person's life than if they live by the precepts, depending what they do and what they say. And so though these are unwholesome, these will lead to suffering. That which is beautiful, that which is wholesome, we do wholesome things, good things in a sense, when we can, that tends in the direction of something called the beautiful. A beautiful mind, a beautiful heart. It tends towards a certain kind of happiness. And I use the word tend so we don't think there's a cause and effect relationship. But if certain things tend in a certain direction for years and decades, they tend to go in that direction more and more. And if we're interested in our long-term happiness, we want to kind of do the things in the short term that have good consequences in the long term. And not to think in cause and effect way. Sometimes that's then we have an exchange system, maybe. If I do X, then that Y will happen. But rather, in terms of conditions. And we contribute conditions, but we don't necessarily determine the outcome. But we contribute the best conditions we can for our life. And then hopefully that turns out well. It tends to go in the right direction. And so a lot of Buddhist practice is not about causing, making something happen, making yourself concentrated, but rather putting in place the conditions that support the possibility of concentration. And then Dharma willing, maybe we'll get concentrated. And if Dharma doesn't will that, the conditions don't come together concentrated, the conditions for concentration are just great conditions for other things as well. It moves us in this beautiful direction. So there's these two directions, towards the unwholesome or towards the beautiful. So generosity is towards the beautiful, stinginess is towards the unwholesome. But then there's a third possibility, and that is it moves us towards freedom. Moves us to a state of being that is not involved or entangled with conditionality. where we're not so influenced by the conditions around us or within us. Even if they're beautiful conditions, we're not caught in them or necessarily influenced by them. If you like a particular food that's really nice for you, it reminds you of your wonderful childhood, perhaps, or something. But then whoever they are decides this is all you can eat from now on. You know, after a while, you give me a break. So the idea of only creating beautiful consequences, you know, beautiful mind, has its limitations. And the alternative is to have a mind that's free. And a mind that's free can act in the world without the actions that we do further creating further conditions. But as we move in this direction, acting in a dharmic way, practicing the Dharma, and a little bit getting out of the way of ourselves, there is this other, it creates the conditions for something beautiful, wholesome, to begin moving through us. And this is the Dharma. Buddhists call it the Dharma. Maybe other people would call it something different. And there seems to be this natural momentum in our hearts, our minds, and our being towards freedom. And so that has much less to do with what we do, in terms of making something happen, and more to do with setting in the conditions to allow something to grow and develop. And it's not so much a condition so off much to do something. It's a lot to do with getting out of the way, letting go, opening up, allowing, but to do so in just the right way. So conditioning is one of the important kind of foundational kind of perspectives for Dharma practice, understanding how we're conditioned. And we're deeply conditioned by our experience of life and childhood and into adulthood, all things that happen to us and can have a big, big impact on us. And many of us are negatively impacted by our life experiences, and it has this big impact on our psychology, our way of being in the world, how we see the world, how we hold ourselves. And the sad thing about that is that then it keeps us. Sometimes it's too easy for it to keep us kind of locked in, to closed, or not allow a kind of healthy unfolding to continue. If you're a boat and you want to be safe, you maybe stay close to, you stay attached to your mooring in the harbor. But that's not what boats were made for, to be, always attached to the mooring in the harbor. So human beings were made to always be in the safest possible place. We're not free that way. Now, this world of conditioning implies or is based on the notion that things change, that things are not fixed. Especially now we're talking specifically about our psychology, the working of the mind, the workings of the heart. From the Buddhist point of view, nothing in there is fixed. It's all changing and changeable. And in fact, the teachings on conditionality as I read it in the ancient texts, the suttas with the Buddha, the emphasis was not on conditionality itself, like conditionality itself is some wonderful principle, but rather the teaching conditionality is a kind of proof, in a sense, that nothing is permanent, that consciousness is not permanent, that our dispositions are not permanent, that our feelings are not permanent, our thoughts are not permanent. All the things that, you know, make up our psychophysical being, none of it is considered to be unchangeable. And in ancient India, there were people who took parts of the psychophysical being of who we are and assumed or believed that this was fixed and unchangeable. And so the Buddha needed to have a proof that it was changeable, so that people would believe him when he talked about the value of shifting the conditioned world, to adjusting or changing or caring for this world of conditionality, so we wouldn't get attached and hold on and cling in such a way when we cling, maybe things don't change so much. Believing that things don't change and clinging to that, maybe it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so he had to kind of loosen people up so they're willing to enter this world of change and participate in a wise way. And the world of conditionality in terms of our own minds is the world of karma. Karma is basically this idea that whatever we do contributes conditions to how things will unfold from there. And so it's good to be careful with the conditions that we put in place. So if you spend all your time watching the shopping channel, salivating about all the wonderful things you can buy and get and how wonderful your life be, and that's all you ever do, that puts in place a certain condition of dissatisfaction, of desiring, of certain mindset of what life is all about. If instead of watching the shopping channel, you spend your days maybe helping at a local soup kitchen and seeing how much happiness it brings people to be able to get a meal, and that sets in motion a very different set of conditions. Dispositions and understandings. So the Buddha put a tremendous emphasis that things change. Things, there's alteration in things. They become different than what they were. And as many of you know, also that things are inconstant and impermanent. They pass away. They're not always there. So the teachings on the ordinary dependent arising, the 12 steps, is a teaching that emphasizes the conditionality of our suffering. And sometimes people take this as a strict, linear kind of description of the necessary conditions. Maybe they are, but I don't know if they're necessarily linear. And then I don't think they're meant to be the only conditions for suffering. But they do, they're a teaching that suffering is not fixed. We're never stuck in suffering. It's there because of conditions. And we can't know all the conditions for it. And because we can't know all the conditions, there's a tendency in Buddhism to not identify so much with the suffering as being I'm responsible. Or that, you know, even that this idea that this is me suffering. In ordinary way, it's normal to feel that, but rather to see there's a kind of non-personal quality to the causes and conditions that have brought it in place. And so to not then not assume or put the weight of self on top of it. What have I done? I must have done something wrong if it's bad, if it's suffering. But there's a kind of a lightening up around the conditionality and the responsibility and, oh, it's there because of cause and conditions. I don't have to know them all, but I can begin investigating them. I can look at them more deeply and see what I can learn and how I can practice with them. And I can maybe put in place other conditions. So the ordinary 12-fold dependent arising ends with this description. The last step is aging and death, grief, lamentation, pain, despair, and anguish. So this is quite a wonderful list or tragic list. Grief, lamentation. I don't know if we lament so much in the modern world, but the alternative translation for lamentation is wailing. So I don't know if modern United States, how much wailing goes on. But it's quite, you know, strong language. Pain, dejection or despair, and anguish. Anguish is another strong word. The word for grief, sukha, is related to a word meaning to burn. So it's not just sorrow or sadness, it's something that really burns. So maybe grief is such a strong word. Maybe that matches this idea of burning and sorrow and sadness. But it's kind of significant that they kind of these powerful words are being used here. And in a sense, they represent the ordinary human condition that sooner or later, sometimes too soon, many people have these experiences. The liberative dependent arising, that the dharmic process of unfolding, also kind of builds on conditions. And the first condition for that process is dukkha, often translated as suffering. And the reason why dukkha is first is that the liberative dependent arising, the path of liberation, is to free ourselves, become free of dukkha, free of suffering. So it just happens to be that the condition that's required to become free of suffering is first to suffer. So, so don't suffer so you can become free of suffering. You know, that doesn't make sense. But, if you happen to be someone who suffers, then this is where it begins. And there's something, it's said sometimes that everyone comes to the Dharma because of suffering. I don't know if that's exactly true, but I think for many people. So it's a real appreciation for this. And what I find interesting is that the ordinary dependent arising, it's more, it's these dramatic words, grief, lamentation, pain, despair, anguish. The beginning of the liberative path doesn't have that long list. It just has dukkha. And it happens that the most literal meaning of dukkha is pain. In English, we say suffering all the time. And because it's, in that sense, perhaps we understand it as psychological pain, emotional pain. But the core meaning is pain. That's where it's. And so the word pain applies to so much if we understand that psychological and emotional suffering is a kind of emotional pain. So I think there's a very, so the doorway to finding the path to liberation is our suffering. It is a path, it is a door. And the task of us as practitioners is to approach our suffering, not to suffer better or suffer more, but to approach it with respect, maybe even a certain kind of reverence or care, to approach it so we can find how it's a door to the path of practice, so we can recognize the path. And the way that this is reworded from the end of the first list to the beginning of the second, I think is quite significant. Because things like, and maybe you'll disagree with me, but the way I'm seeing it is these dramatic words of, in this context, maybe it's the English word grief doesn't do it justice, but grief, lamentation, pain, despair and anguish are these strong words that I think are suggesting our entanglement with those pains, that somehow the self is involved, we've identified with it, we are reacting to it, we are leaning into it, we are pulling away from it, that there is an involvement with it all. And the two key things that the Buddha talks about in terms of these powerful states of pain is there's some kind of self-identification with them, and there's at some kinds of attachment with them. Without attachment and without identification, maybe it would just be pain, but it wouldn't become grief, lamentation. The word pain is there, but let's just put that aside for now. Grief, lamentation, despair, and anguish. If I'm allowed to do a little aside. I studied for a while with a Zen teacher named Robert Aitken Roshi. And near the end of my time with him, he wanted to, write some kind of book about early Buddhism, teachings of the Buddha or something. And he wanted me to help him a little bit. And he came to me with a proposal about how to write about or talk about the Four Noble Truths. And he wanted to translate dukkha as anguish. And I just thought, that's strange. Where did he get that idea? So anyway, so I never really worked on the project. It kind of fell away, but I was remembering now that anguish. And so this idea that, we're somehow identified with it, define ourselves by it, negatively define ourselves by it, what we're not, somehow we're caught. That's what actually gives strength to these things and power and some of the reasons why they're so overwhelming. The beginning of the liberative path, the Dharma path, comes from it comes from really recognizing, beginning in step one, beginning with dukkha, not shying away from it, not overlooking it, but not doing it with identification, not doing it with attachments, and seeing. Being present for and seeing it in some kind of very simple way. And that's why here in this point, it's just called dukkha or just called pain. Oh, this is pain. This is painful. This is painful. But seeing it without identification or as little as possible. Seeing it without attachment, or at least as little as possible. And so to so what does that mean? How do we do that? How do we respectfully acknowledge our pains, physical, emotional, psychological. How do we sit and really, in what ways do we look at it? What ways do we look it right in the eye and see it? Or a different kind of metaphor for it is how do we sit in the middle of the fire calmly, still? And there's something about looking it in the eye, looking at it, gazing upon it calmly, gazing upon it non-reactively. Something about sitting in the middle of the fire calmly, with a kind of stillness. The tradition talks about being unmoving, but a certain kind of being still. The opposite of being still is being reactive. So, if you want to find the path, recognize the path, and the suffering is strong enough, then the art of practice is to see if you can find your way. To gaze upon it kindly, to gaze upon it with stillness, or to sit with it calmly without seeing it through the lens of me, myself, and mine. Without, there's all kinds of ways that me, myself, and my come into play. One would be to feel shame. I'm a shameful person, or the idea that I'm wrong, I made a mistake, or the idea that I can't, this is too much for me, or the idea that that I'll be an acceptable person once this goes away. So I'm just kind of come up with some different ideas. You can probably feel you can describe this better yourself. How me, myself, and mine come into play. And it's kind of it's a different paradigm. So it's actually difficult to do. It's a whole different orientation that's very different than what we were taught growing up. and what our culture kind of really deeply, the conditioning our culture provides, family, all kinds of things, around self and identifying and asserting and denying and proving and being a self and measuring a self and judging a self and keeping things because they're mine. And it's so powerful. But the Dharma is a different paradigm. And the Dharma involves sitting and looking at suffering, being with it, in a very radically simple way. In one way that people can find this simplicity is to appreciate that we don't know all the causes and conditions for our suffering. We also don't necessarily know what is being worked inside of us. We don't know what inner process is happening. We don't know, maybe it's necessary to go through this. Maybe something is working itself out. Maybe something's finding its way. There are all kinds of very strong, difficult emotions that are not mistakes, but rather something is trying to find its way. Something is trying to move and process. And if we can be still and calm and look upon it kindly, just be willing to feel it just as pain. Not feel it as I made a mistake or I'm a failure or whatever it might be. Just to see it and be with it very simply. So one way to do that, as I say, one way to do that is not to identify with it, not to burden it with ideas of me, myself, and mine. So maybe you already know something about how to do this. Maybe your heart knows something already about how to do this. That no matter how big the fire, no matter how challenging the pain is, that maybe there's a way of being present for it while getting out of the way of it. Being very present for it without being entangled with it. Without being attached, or without interpreting it that it has something to do with me, myself, and mine. That we define ourselves, so we don't have to define ourselves by it. It's not denying that it's there. It's just seeing it through a different lens. And the possibility with this different lens is that you discover the path of practice, the practice of mindful attention to what is. Discover how that this way there's glimmers of freedom, of peace, of the closed fist of the hand beginning to open. Maybe it's just a little finger first. That just a little bit tries to open. Just to test the waters. Is it okay? Maybe the boat frees itself in the mooring and at least goes boating around the harbor. Beginning, just the beginning to explore and feel what's this like. So I believe that you all know something about this different paradigm. And if you think I'm wrong, that you actually don't know, don't have a clue about it, so how to find this, your way to this, I would suggest that you try it anyway. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Kindly, compassionately, learn to breathe with your pain. Learn how to be comfortable with discomfort. Learn how not to be pushed around by inner difficulties. Learn how to observe and watch and be interested. Learn how to be mindful. And as we do so, then we are if we do identify, then rather than identifying with our suffering, we begin identifying more with the Dharma or with the awareness, with the mindfulness. We identify more with the ability to see and observe or sit still and quiet in the middle of it. If compassion is needed, if forgiveness is needed, if generosity is needed, if caring deeply about ourselves or about our pain is needed, then as we sit there, we might recognize that we can sit there still and quiet and begin offering the healing forces that help our attachments, help our identifications, help them to begin to thaw, to soften, to fade away. It's the nature of grief, lamentation, pain, despair, and anguish to fade away. To come to an end. It's its nature. That's what's inherent in it as the movement, the direction it wants to go as our suffering moves towards freedom. So the door to the path is in our suffering. And if we look through that door, the path is found in how we are mindful of that suffering. And to do so with infinite patience. It's almost as if, believe it or not, you should have the policy that, well, I'll be here with this suffering as long as it takes, even if it's forever. I'll be that patient. Anything short of that, and you're probably still entangled, probably still caught in it. So generous, such generosity, so open, so willing, so patient, and to see it in this new paradigm, the Dharma paradigm. And if you do that, then the path will keep opening. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow, the next steps of the path. So I sincerely hope that you enjoy this process. It's one of the great, great, wonderful things to do in life, to be on the Dharma path. So I hope you enjoy it and find much happiness, and that you'll come a day when someone will ask you about suffering and you'll be so happy to talk about it, because you know something about where it goes. Thank you.